Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
I look forward to a day that we actually get back to where you can buy investments on fundamentals and not popularity, propaganda, and hype.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of Finance U, where we discuss all things financial in a way that hopefully everybody can understand. With me today again, Paul Kiker of Kiker Wealth Management. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Chris. Good to see you after surviving a windstorm last night.
Oh, did you? You had a windstorm, did you?
We did, but we survived it, brought the chainsaw on the way to work, came through, no trees down, so we were good.
Oh, that's nice. That's nice. Yeah, I wince our windstorms because I got two large trees that are not looking healthy, and I'm just praying they make it through the winter, because if they come down, we'll have a mess. They're going to take some stuff out, right?
Yes, yes.
We got a garden at risk. We got a power line at risk. It could be a mess, you know? So, well, good. Glad you made it through that. Speaking of which, last night was also, at the time of this recording, that was Trump's speech. Not a State of the Union. It was just sort of a Reagan-esque, I'm going to just sort of chat here with Congress for a while. I stayed up for it. And including the Democratic response. I think we should talk about some of it, because some of it feels market moving to me, potentially.
I believe so.
Not least of which is, it became painfully obvious that the opposition party right now, which is the Democrats, and of course that glove goes on the other hand from time to time, they have no plan of their own, Paul, and their plan is to be obstructionist. And I know we've got budgets that need to be resolved, and there's going to be decisions that have to be made. And these could all have real market-moving impacts, I think.
I believe so, too. And I believe the market is starting to realize that this is a completely different administration than what occurred in 2017. Mm-hmm. And it's going to happen slowly, because bull markets do not die easy. But this excess volatility we have, I believe, is people starting to wake up to realize this is a different environment than what they expected. The problem is the average citizen, average individual hasn't figured that out yet.
So let's start here. The first thing I want to talk about is the Fed runs something called FedNow. It's a GDP sort of like prospective calculator. The FedNow is saying, Paul, what happened? So what happened? Let me talk people through this for anybody who's just listening, not watching. I got a chart up here. It's from the Atlanta Fed. It's called GDP Now. It's the real-time GDP estimate for the first quarter of 2025. Of course, we're already in March. So some of this is rear-view mirror. And what we're seeing here is the blue-chip consensus is just lightly floating along in this blue line, and it's been sort of lightly coasting up all quarter, January, February, into March. The top 10 and bottom 10 average forecasts from all the blue-chip economists out there think we're going to get about a 2.3% economic growth for the first quarter, but the Atlanta Fed GDP Now estimate fell off a cliff, lost 5 full percentage points, and is now sitting at -2.8%. This is a true cliff dive. I've never seen anything like this in this series before.
I have not either. And I've heard all kinds of explanations of its front-running tariffs and the trade surplus deficit issues are causing this. But if that is the case, then why in the world did the consensus and the market, you know, gurus out there with the big warehouses not pick up on that?
I don't know, but that's pretty stunning, from +2.3% to -2.8%. That's a big deal. Yeah, that fell off pretty hard. So if we get that recession, that's not really baked in. I think, you know, what we're seeing now, and I know you're as nervous as can be watching these markets sort of like spike up, spike down. You tell me what your perception is, but as a guy who's been in the markets for a long time, that's what tops and bottoms used to look like to me, Paul. Wildish sort of swings as people are trying to figure out, is like, is the bull market back? Is it not back? I'm hopeful. I'm greedy. I'm fearful, and on, and it swings. But that volatility seems to be something you find at turning points. What do you think?
No, I believe so. And this is just further confirmation of my estimate, you know, because nobody knows what's going to happen in the future. We can get professional educated guesses. that we were going to have a topping process similar to the year 2000. And in the year 2000, up until May, you had this massive amount of volatility back and forth and back and forth. And the market established this range to where it'd get down to, you know, it broke some short-term support, and then it would bounce furiously up, and then it would sell off at resistance, and then finally it cracked later in the year. So, you know, a lot of what I've been sharing with the listeners out there is essentially on defense warning, right? Think of a tornado warning. Tornado warning tells you that these are the conditions that can generate a tornado, but it's not till you get a tornado watch that you really need to start running for cover. So we're getting more information that we are within the hair of a gnat's behind. That's how close we are to being on defense watch where we're actionable. So I believe that this is continuing to unfold as a market top. You're going to have this massive back and forth. Bull markets do not die hard. And I believe this process is going to be, you know, excess volatility. And then at some point, we're going to start that momentum down, maybe with a couple of rallies back up that will, you know, bring that euphoria and the desperation for a lot of people out there that are caught up in the emotions of the greed and fear cycle before we finally get the worst part of the decline. So all of the information we're looking at right now is telling us that even with some of the positions, we now have the green light to sell into these rallies to get more defensive.
Hmm. Okay, that's what a watch means for you, selling into those rallies, more defensive. Now, you heard last night, if you heard it, Trump clearly said, and this was astonishing to me, and people stood up and clapped. Well, Republicans did. Democrats just sat there. He said, we're going to have a balanced budget. I can't even imagine a balanced budget at this point in time.
No.
Right?
No. I was shocked by that as well, Chris.
That could have huge impacts. I mean, if you have a balanced budget, I think you also have a ripper of a recession on your hands. Do you not? Unless taxes went way up? I don't understand.
I would assume that it has to be, because if we get to a balanced budget, that's going to be deflationary. So think of what the government has been doing. Is there are a lot of companies that are dead companies walking. I can't remember the statistics right now because this just came to mind, but there's arguments between somewhere around 20 to 40% of the Russell 2000 companies do not have the revenue to service their debt. So all of this reckless fiscal spending, which we're finding a lot of it was corrupt and circling its way back into the pockets of our political leaders, has basically been plugging a lot of, you know, it's like a swimming pool that has a hole in the backside. So they're just flooding it with all of this fiscal stimulus, which keeps these companies floating, right? It just keeps them alive because they're able to, you know, through inflation and other assets, survive another day. If we're going to balance that budget, that's a lot of excess capital that's, you know, foolish capital that's coming into the economy. And I would anticipate that that's deflationary, and that goes along with the line. And one thing I noticed, I want to know if this stood out to you. So Trump made the comment yesterday, market was down, you know, down, rallied, and then puked into the close coming into the speech last night, Wednesday. And Trump pointed out how interest rates went down yesterday. He didn't try to jawbone the market. He didn't try to do like he did in 2017 and use that as his gauge of success. He said, we had a big, beautiful drop or something along those lines, a beautiful drop in interest rates. And that's a completely different environment from 2017, but you've got a lot of market participants that are assuming that he cares more about what the market does than anything. And if he's focused on labor, the average individual, get interest rates down, allow some deflation to occur, that's going to be at the expense of capital, which are some of these companies that have excess profits because of, you know, the international gaming that they can produce things over there to maximize profits. So if we get a balanced budget, I would anticipate that that's deflationary in general.
Well, it has to be because, you know, the GDP equation is, you know, X plus I plus G plus G, the government, right? And so if government is deficit spending around 7% of GDP, and it goes back to deficit spending 0% of GDP because it's a balanced budget, no deficit, that's a 7% haircut plus a multiplier.
Yes, yes. Yeah, yes. Plus the extra bankruptcies that will take place of those companies that are barely holding in there that can't service their debt. But Chris, it's needed. I mean, unfortunately,
I know,
it's going to hurt people, and I know you know that. But that's what I just keep encouraging people is if they, you know, if it's a attempted controlled descent of the markets, and this is just theoretically speaking, then hopefully it scares people enough to where they can position their portfolios, lower their risk level, critically think about where this thing is going and not get wiped out. But the reality is there is more than enough information to tell investors that this is not a time to gamble. And unfortunately, past behaviors of the Biden administration and others has turned the markets into a gambling hall more so than an investing hall. And if we have to, if this pulls out, if we don't do it, we're bankrupt as a nation, then we're going to get back to the fundamentals of investing. And I'm not going to enjoy the pain of getting there. And Lord willing, our strategy is designed to lower risk, to give clients every signal and potential to play defense. That's what our job for them is, to protect that capital. But I look forward to a day that we actually get back to where you can buy investments on fundamentals and not popularity, propaganda, and hype.
Hello, everyone. I'm Chris Martinson of Peak Prosperity, and I want to tell you about something. So you've probably heard about the Great Reset. You know things are highly uncertain right now. There are things happening in the markets that just don't make a lot of sense. And there's an unfortunate conclusion lurking under all of that, which is that there's some people out there, I call them the raccoons of Wall Street, who have found ways legally, air quotes, legally, to take your money, your wealth, your stocks, your bonds, maybe even your house from you. This falls under the idea of something called the great taking. And it's a fairly complicated topic, but this is what I do, and I do exceedingly well. I will find ways to understand this and communicate it to you. And I'll find the other experts out there who are just the best at figuring out what you can do and how you can understand this thing. Now, I hope that nothing comes of this great taking idea. I hope that the trigger is never pulled, but it might. So to help you get there, we have the Great Taking webinar, a variety of experts, and we have 7 strategies that we will outline and also are contained in this workbook that comes along with the Great Taking. It's there anytime you want. Once you have secured your access to the Great Taking webinar, you'll be able to download it, look at it, and view it anytime you want. And you should actually do this with people you love, other people you care about, and anybody else you think who might need to know this information. So with that, please consider taking advantage of this amazing offer to get educated and then take action to protect your wealth, because the Great Taking, it's a very real thing. Obviously, they wouldn't have spent so much time finagling the law and putting in this trigger if they didn't mean to pull it one day. Let's hope that they don't, but if they do, I want you to be on the right side of the line so that you're not on the Great Taking side of the line. Now, back to our program. There's a lot of, you know, we can talk about NVIDIA and things like that. Obviously, there's places where you get that speculative sort of classic bubble, right? We have a story and we got credit, and next thing you know, we're off to the races. But how about this, Paul? Like, never, ever forget, never forget that we had Walmart trading at 40 times earnings. Okay? Come on. Walmart with a PE of 40? Are we cray-cray? I mean, we hit that 37 back there in 1999, and everybody looks back and goes, oh, yeah, that was stupid. But this time, what's not stupid, Paul, this time is different. Like, let me put you on the record of saying I'm a fan. This should go back to a PE of 10. And that would allow people who are currently working and putting into 401ks to buy into a good company at a reasonable price. And that's a good thing over the long haul. Now, it's going to not be good for everybody who has dreams and fantasies about their future because they think 40 is the right price. But listen, we got to do what's right for the country. That's the strain I heard over and over again. And what Trump was saying was like, hey, we're going to make America great again. He's got this sort of very shorthandish way of talking about it. But he's basically, you know, Paul, this is interesting because it was the thing that got set up was, I'm going to do everything I can, Trump said, so that the producers in this country have advantages. If there's 10 regulations on the books, we put a new one on, we take 10 off. Mm-hmm. We're going to bring in people, not willy-nilly across the border. We'll have a $5 million like Visa Club. Like, you can come in and be part of us if you can pony up $5 million, you can buy your way in under the theory that most of those are probably going to be highly successful, dynamic people, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe not all of them, but, you know, on balance, I think that's a safer bet. than just letting people randomly come out of jails and go across your border. That's what I saw setting up, is he was saying, look, we're going to do everything we can for the productive people in this country. And that, of course, put one whole half of that house under very stern. They were very angry with that idea, because there are many of them are. That's what this whole thing just got revealed, Paul, was all these people were just grabbed. They're just like, they're the tick on the hound, right? They're just like, listen, don't take my hound away. I have no idea where blood comes from. I just know that I need it, you know, and they were there busy. They're very angry. They're very angry that their gravy train got taken away. But for me, as a small business owner, I couldn't be happier, because I think everybody ought to be productive or given the chance to be.
I think so, too. And you should have everyone competing under the same laws with and some not above and below. And let me give you a real world example. This is the first time that I've heard this. So I have a friend that owns a business, without getting into the details, because somebody in the North Georgia area may be listening. They've had to compete against a group of illegal immigrants that have caused problems. They've been in and out of the jail, but released and things of that nature. They don't have workers' compensation insurance. They don't have any of the insurance that's in there. So all of a sudden here recently, they did something poor. And I'm not saying immigrants. I'm talking about illegal is what they were competing against. But they're undercutting everyone's price. Okay, so what that's doing is that's pulling their ability to compete down. But these individuals were illegal. They're held to a different standard by the prior administration. Not so much in Georgia, but it's still there, right? So they were dragging those prices down. Well, they made a mistake, did a lot of damage for the customer. Investigation comes in. They arrested them, find out they had some illicit businesses on the side. They had links to the cartels. They deported them out of the country. Instantly, they said that their business and conversations became a little bit better. Yes, prices rose a little bit, but it rose to the price that they're competing against those that are operating by the same rules that they are. And if we continue to do that across the country and remove those that are here illegally and they're, you know, they're not following the laws of the land and forcing those of us that are to fight with one or two hands behind their back, that's going to be good for the middle class. That's going to be good for the small business. And I love the fact that Trump came up with paying for the visa. Other countries do the same thing. And that's going to get the best and the brightest. We want to bring the best and the brightest. We want to build a football team out of the best and the brightest that we can get in there. But that's not what the Democrats have been doing. And like you said, it's clear as day that they were doing it for their own benefit and for the benefit of capital, right? Because if you're a big corporation and you've got these individuals that you can pay half the price that you do your average American citizen, and because they're illegal, they don't have the ability to fight you like the average American citizen does. That is extra profits for the capital, and it's also extra votes for the Democrats that want to, you know, give them all the benefits most Americans don't qualify for.
This happens in my state, right? So our governor, Maura Healey, right? She's all about, oh, we're going to sanctuary, we're going to protect all these illegals, right? And Tom Homan's been speaking to her directly and reminding her of Title 18, Section whatever. But she's just very clear about this. No, we have to protect the rights of the rights of these migrants to come in and earn. You know, they have families. She's very caring, right? But if I want to actually have workers legally in this state, ooh, well, we've got unemployment insurance. You got workers' comp. You got all this stuff you have to jump through. We have a $500 a year filing fee just to have an LLC in the state. On and on and on. And when you add all that up, the burden on somebody doing it through the front door legally so you don't get in trouble is this high. And she says, but the people I care about protecting most are the people who have zero burden on that. And it's just, it's wrong. It's wrong. Fundamentally wrong. Yes. To do it that way.
Yes, it is. It is. And I get, look, I will tell you. So we have a rather large Hispanic community in the North Georgia area where we are. They are family-oriented. They work hard. They save hard. They're some of the best people that you've ever met in your life. That's not mm-hmm. what we're mad about. Nope. We're mad about the illegal criminals that are coming in from the cartels and you know, that left jails of other areas But even still, you know, the legal immigrants that came in, they're just as frustrated because they're having to compete at the levels we are of the illegals that came in, and they don't believe that it's fair to them, a lot that I have talked to in their family. So I think this is something that, it finally reached a point to where we did have that mandate to, you know, for Trump to get the popular vote and say, look, we're tired of the ways that, you are taking us in with Democratic Party and your career politicians. And I was shocked at the fact that they couldn't even cheer a blessing that that Trump bestowed upon a cancer survivor and a young child. It got me teary-eyed. And then I instantly went to anger over the fact that you don't even have the integrity that you care enough about the American citizens in general and a young child that nearly lost his life and not even imagining what that family went through because you hate Trump so much that you can't agree with that.
That's the thing. So they've just become an opposition party. And I just went through this on Signal Hour. I'm not going to go through all this again, but this was the Democratic respondent to Trump, which was Slotkin out of Michigan, right? So at any rate, she's talking about immigrants here, and she makes a point that's really, well, okay, I'm just going to have to play this one piece because it's just that ridiculous.
But actually fixing our broken immigration system is dealing with the symptom and not the disease. America is a nation of immigrants. We need a functional system keyed to the needs of our economy that allows vetted people to come and work here legally.
Yes, she said, stopping the border doesn't make sense because what we really need is a system of vetting so that we get the people our economy needs. Like, yeah, lady, that's called immigration. This is what it looks like. It's a 70-box process. Getting your green card is not easy. We have a process. It already exists. This is not immigration. This is migration. Totally different concept. I keep making this point over and over again because they keep mixing it up like, oh, you're against immigrants. Like, nope, this is an awesome process. Maybe it's cumbersome. Maybe it could be streamlined. This is not an awesome process. Totally different thing. It's got a different term, all that stuff. But I'm worried, Paul, here from a market standpoint, because when you have that level of opposition that's just busy obfuscating simple terms, can't get simple words. We can't even manage migration versus immigration. We're going to smoosh them together. Are these people going to have a sustained, subtle budget conversation when we're trying to get to a 0-point budget? This is going to be rough. I want people to be ready for that. Paul, I see disruption coming in the markets because these people are going to obstruct everything they can just because they hate Trump that much that their internal dialogue and friend group says, I have to just oppose everything he does automatically. Whatever is proposed, I have to be against it.
Our elected leaders are supposed to have different ideas. You find the right path by having opposing ideas and you hammer, you know, like iron sharpens iron to do what's best for the American people. So when I look at the fact that they can't even celebrate an incredible gifting to that child that survived cancer. And I had friends that have been through that. It's a tragedy that impacts a family. So we should be celebrating. They couldn't even stand for that. I agree with you. They want Trump to fail and I think they want Americans to have pain. I really do, because they don't want Americans to vote for Trump or any of his policies. So I believe based on that action, that's a hint that they're willing to do anything to cause him to fail because they can't agree with anything that he's doing, even if it's good and for the benefit of someone else. So
including if they have to spike the economy to make a point, right?
Yeah.
Oh, this'll make Trump look bad. Let's spike the economy. I think we have to get ready for that. And you know, when it's long in the tooth anyway, you know, recessions are not these. It's funny, Paul. It's like watching the whole measles thing. They're like, oh, no, measles is the worst thing ever. And I don't know if you saw, but somebody dragged out the Brady Bunch episode on measles, right? Back when I was a kid, that was cool. You got like 3 days off of school. You had a little rash and maybe a light fever. And that was the end of that, right? That's what it used to be. But now it's like this, oh, horrible thing. We have to avoid at all costs. It's the worst thing ever. And so we've been doing the same thing with recessions. Like, oh, no, the Fed's like, we can't have a recession. And so they've been holding it off, holding it off, holding it off. But we all know one's coming.
And, you know, Besant came out, what was it, a couple of days ago, earlier in this week, or maybe late over the weekend, and had some media tours, and basically made the comment, said, look, this is the hangover from the Biden economy. Mm-hmm. This will not be Trump's economy for at least 6 to 12 months, which is true, okay? Because it's going to take some time for these policies to come into place. And, you know, even Trump in his speech last night stated that there's going to be some pain, there's going to be some, disruption, basically along the line, he's saying, but it will be worth it in the end. Now, some people are saying he's talking about tariffs. I saw he's talking about the economy in addition to the tariffs.
So this just came out, Kobayashi letter here. So it's consumers are pulling back on spending. So this goes along with the GDP now, chart falling off a cliff. So the share of Americans planning vacations within 6 months has dropped 5 percentage points to 37%, lowest since the 2020 pandemic. We have, it's one of the largest monthly declines in the survey. We have Americans' perceived likelihood of a recession, for whatever our perceptions are worth in this story, over the next 12 months jumped to 67% in February, a 9-month high. And 26% believe there'll be fewer jobs available in the economy over the next 6 months. So that's not a 26% is not a huge number in that regard. But consumers feel like we're entering a recession. So you get that drop. But that drop in planning to take a vacation, that's normally you don't see big drops like that outside of the context of these gray bars, which are recessions.
Correct.
So consumer confidence, I call it con, is in the dumps presently. So we're getting our warning signs, obviously, market volatility, all this and that. And speaking of things, this is today's market action, very specifically here, March 5th. Markets were all the way down at the 200-day, so they were looking for a bounce point anyway. But they were pretty far down, and then, oh, tariff delay. We're going to delay tariffs, and off to the races. So this is the kind of stuff you sort of see at these turning points, Paul. For me, I think it's pretty typical behavior. The markets are looking for any reason to get that bullish hope back. Because, like, as you said, bull markets, they die hard.
They do. And especially as long as this one has lasted, and as much government intervention has caught people on the wrong side when they decided to lower risk because of breaking levels. And I think what makes it even worse, I see that as, well, number one, I felt like the market was ridiculously oversold. There was a lot of panic. And my question was, what sellers are left, along with the fact that you still have corporate buybacks that are moving at a large pace. So we still have the mechanics in place right now. Now, when this is over, when those corporate profits start to get squeezed because of the deflation that's taking place, consumers starting to slow down, and they start reducing their corporate buybacks, that's going to be one big buyer in the market that's really juiced this bubble that we have been in. And then next, as we start to get unemployment to tick up a little bit, then you're going to have a little bit less of that passive money coming in. And that's the point where the market really gets dangerous, to where maybe we go from consolidating to starting to sell off, just an educated guess later in the year, guys, not a prediction. But then that leads into the ultimate panic sell-offs, and when you get those crash. Bottoms tend to be an event, and tops are a process. Now, 2002, 2003 was a process, but you had some events in there that reached the ultimate low. So yeah, I do believe that this process will continue, and I'm thrilled, because as I've shared before, we have to play the game by the rules that are forced upon us. And that's one of the reasons we've adapted our tools as time goes along. But it's kind of like, I'm nervous as I can be, because our tools tell us to stay in there, and you're hoping with everything that you can, because you've set up in a manner that you have that time to get out before the major declines start to occur. And I'm happy that we're in a position now with some of our sectors that we can sell into the strength if we get these rallies, sell into those resistance levels. And hey, who knows, we might tick up to all-time highs again here before this is over. But this is a completely different environment than what Trump went through, what he did, and how he acted in 2017. And I think few people, I think like Pavlov's dog, investors are gambling right now more so than investing and looking at the big picture.
Well, you know, my position on this, Paul, is that what we see in the markets now, you and I have to react to the prices we see. But we now know that dark pools are more than 50% of the market action. So we don't even know what's actually happening. We see prices and they say, oh, that's the price of Walmart today. And I'm like, is it? You know, because I don't even have access to half of the price information that's out there. Right. So I don't actually know what the big boys and girls are doing behind closed doors. So that's part one. Part two is we know that they've been hyper focused on keeping everybody in the market all the time. But that's Wall Street's job. Right. CNBC and Wall Street. And the Fed, their job is to keep you and me fully invested all the time. That's what they do. But we have some stuff going on, and not least of which is there's a couple of dots I want to connect real quick, because back to my favorite subject, Paul, gold. Can we talk gold for a second? So this caught me when I saw this, that over the past year, NVIDIA is up a hefty 37.29%. Gold is up 38.81% over the past year. And that's at 2890. It's a little higher than that today. And I think NVIDIA is either there, it should be about there today. It's been sort of wobbling around that $1.15 level. But how about that? The number one story has just been exceeded by gold over the past year. I didn't cherry pick a last week. I didn't say last month or these 8 days. That's a whole year, right? Two, massive quantity here. Let me full screen this. Massive quantities of gold are coming in from Switzerland, from the Bank of England, from the LBMA, pouring into the United States. Somebody is taking, Paul, that's almost 200,000 kilo bars coming in to the United States, right? From Switzerland. You know who buys kilo bars? That's not 100 ounce good for delivery Comex bars. This isn't a central bank. These are people. That's typically who buys kilo bars, well-heeled people, because they're about 90, 95 grand for one of those kilo bars right now. And we know that the LBMA has been telling us things like, oh, we're having trouble moving this stuff around. It's heavy. It's heavy. So somebody put a meme on this, you know, which is me watching as the LBMA clowns fumble with their trolleys. And so as we go through that, how about this then? This really caught me. So this comes from Ronnie Sterfil. He's a good guy. If you haven't followed him, look at this. This is gold's performance against currencies, various currencies. So we got USD all the way on the left, the Australian dollar, the Canadian dollar, the Swiss franc. We got the yuan, we got euros, pounds, etc. All the way out through. But look at the bottom down there. The average across all those, so let me hear this bottom row, average across all 15 years, U.S. dollars average 7.3% per year for 15 years. Again, not cherry picking, Paul. I'm picking a big chunk, or Ronnie did. Grabbed a big chunk of data, 15 years. Compared to, if you were in Australia, you had a 9.1% compounded 15-year return off of gold with very low risk, by the way, right? Japanese yen, 10%. But look at this, 2024, 2030, 20 to 40, 26 to 40%. And so far in 2025, we're already at 10-ish percent, right? So that's a big deal. That's a really big deal. So I think gold is telling us something here that we have to talk about, because this is big money moving into gold, right? You and I don't, nobody we know is contributing to that 200,000 kilos in a single month coming out of Switzerland.
And I'll tell you what I see. So I've been recommending gold to clients since I went independent in 2004, had to go independent because the corporates don't want you to do it, or they're not going to compensate you on it. So I am known in the North Georgia area for somebody that deals in the gold market, recommends it, have lots of conversations about it. I have all kinds of people to this day, like had a conversation with a client, not a part of the Peak community, not as educated as the Peak community is, but it's been struggling with NVIDIA, has owned it for a long time. And I keep saying, look, I'd like you to buy some gold, harvest some profits on that NVIDIA and add some gold to your portfolio. He said, why in the world would I want to own gold? It's way too high now, even if it is, but I want to put a whole lot more money in NVIDIA. Well, he's not doing it with me. He's doing it on his own in that case, because I'm kind of pushing back against this. I care about the individual. But every conversation I have with somebody about gold right now is, are you sure it's too high? And now, don't get me wrong, I do anticipate some pullbacks in gold. So I like the idea, if you don't own it, to average in over the next 6 months. If you have a 10% decline, pull 2 months forward. I like doing it the last week of the month because, Chris, we've been watching this long enough. It seems to always get smashed right before statements are generated. But but people will put their life savings on the line for the Mag 7 or NVIDIA in a heartbeat without understanding the fundamentals and the price earnings ratios and the risks that they're taking. And I think a lot of it's because they feel comfortable in that herd. They don't know anybody that's chasing gold right now. So I don't see any signs that the average retail individual is chasing gold.
Now, no, retail's out.
Yeah, retail's out. This is big money out there somewhere. And that's interesting because I don't know anybody that's panic buying gold right now. I'm still having to really coach people in and have conversations. Do this. Look at the long-term picture. Don't worry about instant gratification. Pay attention to what it can do for you in your asset class. Now, go back to 2012, okay, when we were getting sell signals on gold, which was the scariest reduction of any asset class that I've ever reduced, because I like gold from a long-term standpoint. If I had have told people what they wanted, I would have had a line a mile down the road with people picking numbers for me to, you know, sell gold or silver to them, because everybody was chasing it back then. Retail was there. So that's one of the reasons I believe that this gold bull market is not over, because very few people understand what's really taking place behind the scenes, because they're distracted. I say behind the scenes with what gold's taking place. They're distracted by all these shiny objects up here in this narrative that makes them feel good to talk about around the water cooler at their Fortune 500 companies.
Well, I was just, I just interviewed David Russell yesterday. Should be coming out today or tomorrow. And he's the CEO of Goldcorp. And the question is like, hey, who's driving this? And he said, it's not retail. It's just not. It's not the little people. And he said, that's a shame. But he's getting calls now from companies, treasurers, CFOs saying, hey, how do we put this into our portfolio? Family offices, right? Sovereign wealth funds, like big money is starting to say, oh, you know, we maybe want to have some of this parked in our area. It's a totally different conversation. And Paul, the reason I think that little people like me aren't as bullish as we might be about this is because they market against us all the time. Like if you read a gold article and you look at the verbiage carefully, the nouns and the adjectives and all the pieces, and you look at it, it's negative. It's negative. You know, they always say it's not like, you know, NVIDIA, like all time new high. How much higher could it be? You know, they say that, but for gold, they're like, gold's at an all-time high. This is not a good time to buy. Like they're always like, their job is to damp it down, you know? Always. So we're getting psyop. Don't fall for it. I mean, I don't know. I worry that if you understand the system the way I do, you understand that our current dollar system does not have a mathematical resolution, which is a fancy way of saying we're going to have a big old currency accident sometime, right? And I can't predict when, but it just doesn't pencil out, right? There's no combination of things I can see that's going to allow us to escape the implosion of the dollar at some day, right?
No. I mean, it's just a mathematical certainty, and it's the same cycle that we've been through throughout history. And, you know, and the only way to save it, I heard a discussion that Trump should come out and reset the stated price of gold in U.S. dollars and reset it to $4,000 or $5,000 an ounce. So that's great. It'll drift up there in the interim period. That doesn't solve the problem unless we go back to a gold standard type currency where it's linked in there somewhere. So, but the reality is, yeah, you're right. You could sacrifice the dollar in this environment and make the pain a little bit easier. From the standpoint, it's not going to be good if the dollar is sacrificed completely, because that's a hyperinflationary situation in the U.S. But if you can have a controlled descent, there is some balancing that would take place with the tariffs in there to level that playing field. But I don't know that you can do it at this point in a controlled fashion, and it's still going to be painful either way, but we're going to have to go through some pain. I mean, or we're going to end up in a situation like California has recently, to where those fires get out of control and it just absolutely wipes out everything in the area before they can get it under control.
Well, I don't know, Paul, all the things that are going on because I'm out here in the cheap seats, but I can tell you that what's happening in the gold market is unprecedented in the entire 20 plus years I've been watching it. But it goes beyond that. So, you know, I was talking with David Russell. He's like, oh, gold this, gold that. And I kept asking about silver because I think there's a canary in the coal mine here. So TF Metals report, Craig Hemke's good friend of mine, he just put out today, he said 12,000 March silver. Now, March is a big delivery month. There's three big delivery months for silver. March is one of them. But he said 12,000 March contracts have already been delivered for 60 million ounces. 60 million. And I'm like, delivered to whom? And I don't know that, right? But somebody pulled the trolleys up and said, give me 60 million of these ounces, right? And so I'm zooming in on that report a little bit. I just want to note that, okay, there's two categories. One is eligible. You and I might have silver. We're a producer. Anyway, we can put it into a COMEX warehouse. It's eligible because it meets the both the bar weights and purity grades necessary. It's eligible to be used in the system, but it's not part of this. It's just on their shelf. You pay storage fees. But you and I might decide, oh, we're going to move this to registered, meaning it's now registered for delivery. So the registered category is really important. Look at the relationship between 60 million and the total registered. I'm going to round up as 140 million ounces. That was a big chunk of what's possibly available in silver. Huge percentage chunk. Okay. So I don't have to know much, Paul. All I know is that somebody, or a lot of buddies, decided, I don't want ones and zeros on a hard disk in a bank denoting that I have currency. I want shiny rocks. And I'm going to take them out of the vaulting system. It's all I know. Sometimes that's all you need to know.
Well, that's big money that's moving that. Because and you've got, silver is ridiculously heavy. Right. If you've got $1 million in silver, I'd have to do the math to calculate how much that is. You may know off the top of your head. But the reality is it's hard to maneuver. It's expensive to maneuver, a lot more expensive than gold. But that goes right in line with what's taking place in gold. So the question that I would ask, we know about the great taking potential and risk. So if you've got big money that's all of a sudden decided that they don't trust the system enough to leave it there for whatever reason, do they know something that we don't know, or do they just see?
Well, you have to worry about that.
Yeah, so that's what I would worry about. I mean, I want to have physical possession in a safe place, but why would big money like that move? Because it's not retail. I'm not glad that Dave said that it's not retail, because that is unfortunate. But if this is big, connected money individuals, do they see some rot under the system? Are they in businesses that they've been able to play this debt game to the point that if we start to get some deflation, that we have this debt collapse, and then you have to worry about collateral risk? Because the, you know, the great risk would, and this is why I like segregated storage for people who want to have it segregated. And Dave Russell and his company at Goldcorp, we work great with them. They're wonderful to work with, but we want to be segregated, because if you're allocated, there's more risk in that case. And then I wouldn't want to be leasing my gold out anywhere, because the classic banker scheme over time is to lease that gold out multiple times. And then there's a run on the gold, and all of a sudden there's a collapse, and those who don't have physical possession of it lose it. So what do they see that we don't see? I mean, I've never seen this take place before historically in these levels. I just haven't. And I don't think it has occurred historically at these levels.
Somebody knows something. That's all I know. Somebody knows something, and they said, I want physical silver right now, and gold too. I could show you the same story for gold. Same thing. So that's, and you know what? I don't have to be smarter than that. When it comes to things, but this is unprecedented. I just want to leave people with this. I've never seen anything like this. And again, this is not retail. This is, and by the way, if retail ever does get involved, so I've been there for the big corrections, right? 2009, 2011. Remember 2011? I think silver went from like 12 to 8, 50 per, you know, it was huge drop, right? $4 got shaved off in the middle of the night, right? And you would think, oh, what a disaster, right? You know, a third of the value just went away. It's going to have to climb 50% just to get back to even. It's terrible. I couldn't get any silver. First thing I did was I called up. I was like, I like eight, you know, I couldn't get any. They were like, oh, we got a 6-week wait. All the place, because retail, just the few people, I don't know how many silver bugs there were. I was one of them. We were like, yeah, you know, I thought I was going to be unique. You know, I'll buy it when it's cheap. You know, by the time I got on the phone, it was way too late. They were like, oh, yeah, it's all gone. meaning it's a very thin little market. It's a little thin little thing for retail level. But this isn't retail. This is big. Like, this is big. These are the 1,000-ounce bars, weigh about almost 70 pounds, 70 poundish, 60 million ounces left. Went away. Wow. Yeah.
That's a big deal. Well, and talking about the dollar, I'd like to show this chart because this stood out relatively heavy. This is the U.S. dollar index. Okay. So this is as of today. Mm-hmm. And you look at, or the close yesterday. Dollar's been bouncing back, started rallying in October, and then all of a sudden, that's a big move for a 1.3% decline on the dollar in one day to drop this much. And then not only that, you know, we're kind of failing this resistance level down 3% for the week. That's a very interesting move with what's taking place right here. And the question is, do we start getting a weaker dollar? And if you go back, this is a monthly chart right here going back to 2000, 2001. And when the dollar went from 120 in 2001 down to, that's below 75. It doesn't give me the exact number here, around 70 back in 2008. Are we about to repeat a decline that took place from 86 with a counter trend bounce down to 08 with a counter trend bounce to even lower levels? I don't know. But this is a pretty big deal that we failed to hold that level of resistance, technically with a little head and shoulders pattern here, small right-hand shoulder. It's not real clean, but that's a clear break of the prior left shoulder, which gives us a good indication that we're going to see the dollar lower over the next year.
Well, part of the explanation for that has been this. They say on March 4th, Germany loosened fiscal chains. This is yesterday, to transform European defense is how they're pitching it, but that wasn't exactly it. Martin Edemer here in the Bloomberg article out of Economist said the massive shift in fiscal policy likely gives the struggling German economy a shot in the arm. A jump in defense spending may provide a cyclical boost. The proposed infrastructure package could deliver notable potential output gains in the long run, blah, 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 blah. But they said, oh, you know, people are saying that, this is going to be good for European economy. And so that's why the euro strengthened. That's why the dollar fell. I don't get it, because this was massive. So Germany announced, Paul, 10.5% of GDP of new deficit spending that they're going to engage in. This is a big move, one of the biggest moves they've had. They said, carrying on, Christian Brenner down there said, politicians have understood swift and decisive action must be taken now. Well, yeah, what they really needed was to not blow up the Nord Stream pipeline and make their energy ridiculously expensive. So they're trying to paper over with borrowing, Paul, an insult, an injury that happened because of their energy policies. It's not going to work over the long haul, but it's going to give a boost in the arm. And we saw this. This is German bond yields, and that's a pretty big move, about 25 basis points, which that's a big deal right there, German bonds to do that, right? Some people got carried out on a stretcher. Zero Hedge reported that, you know, there's a swap spreads, which is a way of measuring the spread between a German bond and other bonds. Anyway, that's the lowest, that's the biggest, most negative swap spread they've ever seen. Right.
All actions have consequences, some more severe than others.
Yeah. So they're trying, but I, you know, a lot of people, you know, the first thing out of the gate, they're going to spin it positive and they're going to say, oh, this is decisive, bold move. But they're panicking because they know just how badly their economy is doing over there. And this is without any of the war footing stuff and any of that stuff coming. The German economy has been having real trouble, but you wouldn't know it looking at the German DAX still. No.
The DAX is absolutely amazing on what it's done. You know, it hasn't met the criteria to be inside of our portfolio, so it's not been on my radar. But because you've been pointing it out, I've been looking, and just as I get time, go, what in the world is going on? And there's some indexing issues with that. Few companies that are larger percentages are doing, you know, a lot of revenue coming from around the country, but it still doesn't make sense. It is what it is, but it still doesn't make sense.
So we'll keep an eye on that. I don't know what's going to happen with that. one other thing, Paul, we're talking about like the geopolitical or the political dimensions of the economy. One other thing, this was shocking to me also on Zero Hedge today, which the Supreme Court of the United States, the dissenters on an opinion, it turned out in a 5-4 vote, and I'm surprised who was on the five side. The Supreme Court refused to bolster Donald Trump's foreign aid freeze, reinstating a lower court order that requires the quick disbursement of $2 billion out of USAID. The dissent by Alito, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh, Thomas and Gorsuch and Kavanaugh was, they said, quote, does a single district court who likely lacks jurisdiction have the unchecked power to compel the government of the United States to pay out and probably lose forever $2 billion taxpayer dollars? The answer to that question should be an emphatic no, but a majority of this court apparently thinks otherwise. I am stunned. That's a strong SCOTUS statement there to say stunned. Think of the confusion and the chaos that happens when now we have to run fiscal policy past district court judges. It's not how that any of this is supposed to work. I looked at that. I was like, that, what timeline am I on? That's bizarre.
Yeah. Just lawfare across the board. That is bizarre. So now you're adding another level of complexity where you can, you know, the Democratic side can utilize lawfare to stop anything that's taking place and further cause troubles on the American people. All I can think of last night and watching, we all in our lives have seen terrible divorces, right? Where people turn the hatred towards each other and forget about their kids in the interim period. And the kids happen to be a byproduct of all the battles that's taken place and come out with scars and things of that nature. That's what it looks like on a national level right now with the Democrats on the other side, that they can't refuse to see any good, even if it causes damage to the American people, which would be the kids of the whole relationship in there. And it's heartbreaking to me.
I'm stunned too. Like, can you imagine, Paul, that you know, you strike a deal with a roofer, and then he comes back the next day and says, "I'm sorry, but a judge in Kansas has ruled that you have to pay me twice as much for this work."
Yeah,
you'd be like, "What?" It's not the province of the courts to do that. But no. Here we are.
I saw that headline, so I appreciate you taking the time to share that with us, because I saw the headline, but I didn't get a chance to dig into it and read, because I scratched my head when I looked down. I'm like, I got to dig into that later. So thank you for bringing us up to speed on that.
Well, the theme I'm weaving together here is this: the data points say fractured polity, justice is starting to weigh in areas they don't actually belong, and a case precedent has now been set. So think of all the district court judges who are now being shopped by various aggrieved parties who think they need to, you know, have, you know, payment from the government for whatever. The chance of this not resulting in some sort of economic accident is now low. I mean, that's just how I'm seeing it right now. So I'm, you know.
No, I see it the same way. And a lot of indicators are giving us the same across the board. You know, it's watch, defense watch, right? We're in an environment where things can start to come apart. No guarantee that they will, because nobody's going to time these markets perfect. Nobody's going to be able to pick the exact top. There's too many complexities involved. But there are all kinds of signs, warnings. Everything is screaming at us as investors to really pay attention, be careful, take each step with fear and trembling. And I had an interesting conversation, and there's something my grandfather told me that hopefully I'll remember to come back to it in a minute. But I had a conversation with someone the other day. Now that I'm aware of the great taking, they were asking, says, okay, once you get an official defensive signal and you've shifted to full defense, do your tools allow you to short the market? Yes, they do. Okay. They give us a clear signal. Now, I've raised the bar so high because of the Fed intervention and things, and I'm glad we did in the past, because we would have been in and out real short. But you know, that you have a high probability that you're making a wise decision to short the market. But as I've struggled with this, will we do this? Will we not? We've talked about it on the investment committee. why be greedy? You know there's the risk of the great taking. We know the derivatives market is this huge monster that's out there that could, that if something unwinds in the derivatives market, it's going to overwhelm everything across the board when you have that forced liquidation. That's my greatest concern about how the great taking could unfold. So I'm unwilling to short the market on this side of a decline because I don't want to take, say, 30% of the portfolio and be short, and then you have the great taking or a derivatives market blow up and that counterparty fails and you lose the 30% that you have out there because it's not paid. Now, when we look at that, if this thing unfolds and we just go back to median values of fair price market on PE, you're talking about a 40 to 50% decline. If we go to an undervalued market and a price earning ratio of 10, similar to what we did in 1974, you're talking about a 60 to 70% decline. Because so many people are passive investors and there's really no, there are very few, they're out there, but very few risk managers that are going to go to 0% equity exposure if they get that sell signal. You don't have to be greedy on this side of a decline. You just have to protect your capital when this starts to unfold. So, you know, I think this is a period of time where we don't know how severe it could be. We know it can be severe. The best we can hope for is we get a 30% decline or so, and for whatever reason, Trump's policies are able to shore up the economy in some way. I hope that that's what occurs. But this is a time to where you don't want to be really, I don't believe, in my opinion, that you want to be really fancy or greedy on this side. You want to protect that capital, because if this market goes down 60 or 70%, like John Hussman, many others that are out there are warning just mathematically it can. And let's say you're down 5% and you have your capital, then you've got the single greatest opportunity that we've seen in our lifetime outside of the Great Depression. It's going to, if you have the courage and strategy that'll tell you when to redeploy that capital, you're going to be so far ahead of where you were before. You don't have to get greedy on this side of it. I'm not saying that shorting's foolish, because if our signals give us, yeah, it's a wise approach. But what happens if that great taking does unfold and you get a little too fancy and you have a lot of damage? I'm not saying it will. We don't know what the probability is. All I know is it's a risk.
Well, I want to talk about that risk, but, you know, maybe not the great taking. I don't know what could activate that machinery. But look, we know that we have Democrats now who can't stand up for a 13-year-old child with brain cancer who survived that because their politics won't allow them to do that. We also know that the Federal Reserve has stepped in and rescued this market over and over and over again. We also know that this Federal Reserve is more than 90% donates to Democrats. So from an ideological standpoint, is it possible, Paul, that our Federal Reserve would be standing there going, could I find a reason to stand back and not rescue the market this time? Is there something in my ideological toolkit that would say maybe that's the right thing to do? I think we're seeing the front end of that. So this was an opinion in the New York Times, came out immediately after the Trump speech, said it's hard not to protest a speech like that. But this is the opening paragraph, right? It says, just before he spoke, the stock market fell into correction territory, the result of deep concerns. So they're already pinning any decline in the stock market to Trump.
Yes.
So you can see this is a Democratic talking point. This is in the New York Times, right? So this is an ideological rag at this point in time. And they are clearly saying, and this is, could be a trial balloon. They may find something else that sticks better. But they're saying, hey, Democrats, it would be good if we could pin a stock market decline on Trump. So that's just, you know, nothing in my entire adult life. The Fed has always found a good reason to bail the markets out. So I'm just wondering, Paul, do you think, is it possible that by the time you can't stand up and clap for a child who survived cancer, that you are now into a territory where, am I going too far here? But I'm thinking, could I imagine that the Fed might sit there at their table and say, you know, a decline wouldn't be the worst thing?
Well, wasn't it Thomas Jefferson? Was it Thomas Jefferson that stated, if you give the power of your money over to a central bank, I'm butchering that, but first by inflation and then by deflation, they will rob you of all your wealth?
Yes.
Okay. another thing we know is, who was it that was presiding over? Was it during the Great Depression?
Hoover.
Hoover. So you didn't have a Republican reelected for quite some time, if I'm getting that correctly. So if you're on that side and you want power and you want your grift and your graft and your money circling back to you more so than anything else, and you know that you've got somebody in there that is willing to dig in and lay this bare before the American people, then if you want to protect that from a long-term standpoint, you care more about power than you do the American citizens, then absolutely it's possible. Let it come apart. Use your media machine and your propaganda, because if you're still in control there, and propaganda, unfortunately, they do it because it works. I mean, social media, they do it because it works. We're all subject to it unless we really check and question everything that comes out before us. So, yeah, I believe that it is possible, and I am concerned. I hoped in my humanity, because I'm an optimistic person, I want to give everybody the benefit of the doubt. But when they show you who you are the first time, somebody that I really respect says that, believe them, right?
Yeah.
So, Chris, that sticks in my head. I was thinking about that last night. If you can't cheer anything good for that child, and your hatred is so strong there for one individual, then what are you willing to do to cause that individual to fail? You're hoping in every way that they will fail. And then if you can pin anything on them, they're going to use their propaganda machine to try to make sure that he's never elected again. And those policies are something the American people don't want. But I hope that the American people are going to see through it.
Well, I just think that, you know, it's important to consider all dimensions here. And you're right. There are people out there shot through at all levels, could be at the Federal Reserve, could be in Congress, who want this administration to fail.
Yes.
And they will do anything for that, because obviously there's no limit to, I mean, it's, I understand all's fair in love and war in politics, but this feels different. This is more extreme than that to me. Right. So, and that divide is really enormous. And by the way, just to be completely fair, right, I actually can commiserate with the people who looked at that last night, saw Trump, and they're distraught. They're like, how can this be? This is like a terrible thing, because if that was Kamala up there, I would be experiencing those emotions, but on the other side, right? Because she would have gotten up there and probably said something like, to thunderous applause from her side, saying, we're going to propose a constitutional amendment that, you know, men can compete in women's sports, right? And I would have been like, no, not the world I want to live in, right?
No.
So I get that. We're very fractured, and they want to live in a world that's different from the world I want to live in. And I don't know how to put those pieces together anymore, except I can commiserate and say, I get it. If somebody is up there doing things that you really fundamentally, viscerally disagree with, that's painful.
Yes,
right?
It is. And I do get that. But if we're individuals of integrity, and I know you are, I'm going to disagree with that. But if there's something that they said, in that case, if she'd have spoken that and then highlighted that same kid and gave them the same Secret Service membership, honorary, however he got that, I would have still just gotten as teary-eyed as I did last night, because that's a separate issue. And all I can think of, Chris, and this is the problem, they accuse the other side of doing what they've been doing. They walk around believing that they're individuals of integrity. When I was a young man, my grandfather was a man of few words, and I gardened with him all the time. When I got in trouble, I had to garden, and I hated it when I was a kid, but now that I'm older, I love getting in that garden. I think about him all the time. But there was a little box that he had built, like a sandbox. And he told me, he said, hey, go stand in the middle of that sandbox. And I was probably, I don't know, 12 years old. Now, it didn't have sand in it. He built it to put sand in the box. So it's just this box. He said, I want you to imagine that box. That's your integrity. There's a boundary over what you will and won't do in your life. He said, but I'm going to tell you one thing. He had handles on it so that it could be moved easy to put over. He says, if you reach down, he said, reach down, grab them. And I did. And I stood up. He said, now I want you to take two or three steps forward and set that box down. And I said, okay. So I did that. He said, there's a lesson in that. He said, if you're a person that that moves your integrity. You know, you can live a life, if you're not careful, when you compromise your integrity, that all of a sudden you're going to be carrying around your integrity like, I'm this person of great integrity, but you actually have none and you've self-deceived yourself. So the one piece of advice I'll give you in your life is never pick up that box. Wherever your boundaries are, do not cross those. And I've thought about that a lot with some of the actions of our politicians, because they seem so self-righteous. And they're talking about, oh, the emotions of this and the emotions of that. And they've convinced themselves, maybe given over to a reprobate mind, as the Bible would call it, that there are these people of high integrity, but they're so full of hate for anyone who opposes their opinion that they can't even see the good in what is taking place. And even our worst enemies have good in them at some point, or they'll do something good. And we as individuals, I believe, have to celebrate the good and encourage that and stand against the evil, because you want to encourage better behavior. You don't want to encourage evil behavior. And that's one of the biggest concerns that I have. And last night actually scared me for the days ahead that we have a political system that is that opposed to each other.
Yeah. Well, it very well said. I like that. Don't pick your box up. But, you know, it was interesting after all of that, which was, you know, watching this very entrenched foe, and Trump can't do anything right. They got some soul searching to do, Paul, because even CBS ran a poll afterwards, broad approval of the speech, right? And so they're going to have to, you know, that's what I would have wanted to have heard from the Democrats, would have been like, look, I know we were in charge for 4 years and we must have done some stuff that you didn't like, because we just got trounced in the elections. So we've looked at it. And, you know, here are four things that we think we can align with Trump on. Here are three things that we have a lot of questions about that we're going to need some answers on. Here's two things we just can't abide. They said, here are 10 things that we hate. I'm like, that's not a, did you guys see this, you know,
because that is a big deal that it's 76-23.
Yeah.
You know, and look, I'd say 90% of what he said, there's a couple of times where I felt like he took some pock shots that were a little unnecessary to be equal opportunity, you know, and Trump's personality is inflammatory from that standpoint. But don't be surprised by it, because that's who he has been for quite some time. Focus on the things that he's doing, ripping this fraud out. You know, getting rid of the illegal immigration, getting interest rates down, getting the cost of goods down. You know, and look, the tariffs are going to be a painful thing, but he's stated clearly a couple of times, look, I just want to equalize the playing field. And that's good for Americans from a long-term standpoint. Yes, there'll be pain in the short run. But if you remove the incentive for a large Fortune 500 company to go produce their goods in China, you know, a tenth of the cost. Yeah, that's good for capitalists, good for investors, because it maximizes profit at the expense of the labor and the average individual inside the United States. So if we equalize that playing field and we bring jobs back here, that's good for the majority. And it may not be so good for the minority that refuses to see the field changing, right? And for the minority that recognizes, hey, yeah, this has been a good ride. Maybe we should reduce our exposure and not quite be so greedy, and let's reinvest back into the country, then they can adapt. But the problem is people don't adapt in general quick enough, and especially when they've been on a good gravy train.
You know, just to be fair, I think Trump's drill baby drill is naive, personally, because I do a lot of oil and gas investing, and I know that price is what matters in this story. It's not a question of just saying you want more. You need the right price, and if the price was constructive, more comes out of the ground. And the price is currently not constructive. I'm hoping Chris Wright, the new energy secretary, can get some stuff in there. If I had, you know, my druthers, if I had that role, I'd be bending Trump's ear. I'd say, listen, we're going to get all the oil we can out of the ground. Here's some things you could do to maybe reduce some regulatory costs that'll shave a little off a per barrel cost, but you're just going to have to, we're going to need higher prices to get more out of the ground. But I think within the next year, we could build a small modular nuclear reactor, strip away the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's million pages of regulations, get one of these down, put it in Ohio where you say you want to have, like, you know, a renewed car manufacturing, give 3 cents per kilowatt hour small modular nuclear reactor power to one of these plants, show 150 people with jobs now, because the car companies have been like, wow, no tariffs here inside, and I get, you know, cheap power. I'm in. Incentives are everything. And then just say, by the end of 4 years, we're going to have a country with the cheapest electricity cost of any G20 nation. That would be my plan.
That would be huge, and that would be a good plan. And I would, me personally, I'd probably call China, beg them, say, hey, look, what can we do to get your thorium reactor technology? Because you're the one that pointed that out to me. And yeah. I'm like, you know.
Yeah, China just, what, 3-4 days ago said that they found a new thorium deposit. Well, it's a lot of minerals, but thorium was mixed in. And they said it's enough to power them for like 60,000 years or something ridiculous. Like, it's like just a massive deposit. It's huge.
That's a competitive advantage. That's a huge competitive advantage. I mean, how nice would it be for us as citizens if we went back to power bills that were $50 a month across the board just to support, like, lower energy costs is dramatically impactful for individuals, and especially those on the lower end of the economic range.
No, energy is the master resource. If you have, like, if you just, like, Paul, if we came to your community and we put one of these 40-foot storage containers with a thorium reactor in it or a small modular nuke, and we just had a big old cable coming out and we said 3 cents a kilowatt hour, you do what you do. Your community will surprise you. Somebody's going to say, wow, I'm doing pottery because I can fire kilns for nothing. And somebody else will be like, watch me open welding shops. And somebody else will, you know, it won't matter. People will figure stuff out. And that's the point, right? And you won't have to do anything. Humans plus energy is creativity, right? You know?
And that's one thing in our humanity. We're ridiculously creative. But we have to have an environment that will promote that creativity.
Yep. Cheap energy is the lifeblood of that. So Trump's right about that. I think he's going to be disappointed. The drill, baby, drill isn't going to come through. I'm hoping that we can make a push into nuclear because we need it.
Yes. Now, Chris, what about natural gas? I've heard that thrown around that we're just awash in natural gas. Is that true based on your research? And is that something that we could convert and utilize that as well? I mean, I everything I've heard said nuclear is far more efficient, but isn't
depends
that
what you're using the molecules for. So we should never be using natural gas to make electricity, right? Okay. That should be nuclear. But now we have all this natural gas. What would we do with it? Well, it goes into manufacturing processes, right? It's used, as a base molecule to make into longer chain things. And, you know, you make ammonia-based fertilizer requires it and all that stuff. I'm a little worried that we don't have somebody who's been looking at the big picture natural gas. We have a lot, but we don't have infinite amounts, right? And so we just heard last night, this totally confused me because I totally caught off guard. Trump said that we're going to put a natural gas pipeline in Alaska, and that gets us into the Asian market so we can supply our Asian customers with all this natural gas. I'm like, Alaska doesn't have, I was unaware that Alaska had a lot of extra natural gas that it had to get rid of. I didn't know that. So I'm going to have to see what he might have been talking about. Maybe he's pulling it through from Canada. I'm not clear what that was. So I'll have to look into that. But we ought to be saving it. We should never be converting our natural gas into liquefied natural gas and sending it to somebody else. Because it takes energy to take a gas and turn it into a liquid. So that energy, when you make a liquid from a gas, that's what you use that energy for. You didn't build a bridge with it. You didn't fire a kiln with it. You didn't make ammonia with it and grow crops. You spent that energy turning a gas into a liquid. That's what it did. We shouldn't be doing that. You know, gas should be piped, and we've got all these LNG terminals now and more on the books, and I'm really worried somebody hasn't sat down and gone, if we have to supply all of these LNG terminals with gas, how much do we actually have? And you come to a very interesting story pretty quickly, which is like, oh, there's only two places where natural gas output is actually growing. One is the Permian Basin in Texas, which is kind of a good news, bad news story. Good news, more gas. Bad news. Why? because that oil field is playing out. And as the oil fields mature and start to age, they start to become gassier. So more gas coming out of the Permian. It's good news for the gas production. It's bad news for what it implies about where we are in the oil story from that field. And the second is the Marcellus. It's a monster. A lot of drill space left on that, but not infinite amounts. So I hope somebody's going, how many spaces are left? How much is reasonably there? Let's factor in a little fudge because we think technology will get better. That's always a thing. So, but I don't think nobody's done that. We haven't had a plan like that my entire life. So I'm kind of hoping we get one.
Well said. Well said.
I think we're out of time for today. So for anybody who wants to talk with Paul and his amazing team, please come to peakfinancialinvesting.com, fill out a simple form. Somebody from Paul's team will be back with you within 48 hours. And Paul, you've gotten a lot of, I've seen a lot of connections and contacts coming through of late. So I'm very happy to see that people are finding you. That's a good thing.
We have wonderful conversations. I got to tell you, I just thoroughly enjoy meeting everyone that I've met through the Peak community, through listening in on the podcast, some of the smartest, brightest. I haven't said this in a while, but it is true. Some of the smartest, brightest, most caring individuals that I've met. And they care more about the truth and being prudent and being good stewards for what they have accumulated and for that of their family. So it's such an honor to be able to meet everyone. And I look forward to every conversation and it's a blast to come into work. Not the markets and worried about what's there, but it's a blast to come in and be in a position with a strategy that is designed to help people navigate as good as possible what could unfold in the future.
Excellent. Well, thank you for doing that. And thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll be back with you next time. I'm Chris Martinson, and we've been here with Paul Kiker of Kiker Wealth Management. Trade safe, everybody. Keep your head on a swivel. Till next time. Bye for now.